Hi, David Mee here. This is For the Record program number 1338. Conversations with Monty. This is conversation number 12. This is being recorded on July 27th of the year 2024. And once again, it is my pleasure and my privilege to introduce my new co-host, Monty, and he will continue to present the reality of the fascist landscape in which we all live. I was struck when I took a little break there and hydrated myself. A staff member here at the radio station was looking at some video of an equestrian event at the Paris Olympics. And, you know, this stuff may seem like, well, this is old stuff. You know, it's far away. It didn't have anything to do with anything. The International Olympic Committee still bears the stamp of the guy who headed it for many years, of long fascist connection to the Olympics, but Juan Antonio Samaranch was head of the IOC for a long time, and he was Francisco Franco's Minister of Sport and a diehard fascist to the very last. A journalist from The Nation magazine asked Samaranch at a press event how come his right arm was so much more muscular than his left. And the journalist was banned for many future meetings. You know, so you know, people think, well, this is long ago. You know, who cares about this? Oh, no. This is, it is literally in your face. And it really is quite remarkable. Martha, you have been presenting to us, untangling some really important fascist threads, really networks that the importance of which could not be exaggerated. And sadly, they have been eclipsed, if not completely eliminated from the public consciousness. And you've been, among other things, presenting some wonderful research from a brilliant researcher named Jeffrey Bale. Now, Professor Jeffrey Bale, sadly, Professor Bale's work, simply by virtue of the fact that there's so much going on, he has been badly underrepresented, shall we say, in our archives. And it is, I want to give a huge, huge shout out to Professor Bale for the work that he's doing. And you have been unpacking some of this for us, so please do continue with the discussion of the moderate William F. Buckley and his connections to all of these other moderates, you know, moderate Waffen-SS veterans, people like, you know, moderate Otto Skorzeny, and all of the other moderates, and who knows, maybe, you know, we could even view the moderate Adolf Hitler as well as being part of this wonderful moderate political milieu. Go ahead, Marty.
Well, I'd like to quote, just pivoting to the information that we that you left us off on in last program, and I'd like to quote directly from a book called General Walker and the Murder of President Kennedy, The Extensive New Evidence of a Radical Right Conspiracy by Dr. Jeffrey H. Caulfield. And this is from a chapter in his book called Lee Harvey Oswald and the Nazis. And I'd like to talk about a man by the name of Dan Burroughs and his connections to Mr. Oswald.
Go ahead.
let's see. This is from page 76, and I'll just read it from there onward. So, quote, the last notation in Mr. Oswald's notebook, National Socialist Bulletin, highlighted the name of Rockwell's publication. The bulletin featured accounts of photos of stormtroopers' activities. Rockwell considered the Arlington headquarters primarily a printing operation and prized Burroughs's high IQ and printing skills. Burroughs prepared a propaganda booklet for Rockwell and 1 January 1963 wrote the National Socialist Bulletin, which in fact was the publication of an organization called the World Union of National Socialists, which, as I pointed out in the previous program, was co-founded by George Lincoln Rockwell, Sir Oswald Mosley of the British Union of Fascists, and Otto Skorzeny.
The Three Musketeers. Go ahead.
Continuing. Rockwell considered, reading again, Rockwell considered the Arlington headquarters primarily a printing operation and prized Burroughs's high IQ and printing skills. Burroughs prepared a propaganda booklet for Rockwell and 1 January 1963 wrote for the National Socialist Bulletin. Once again, I would stress that's a Skorzeny publication in 1963, and published a newsletter entitled The International Nazi Fascist, which enabled him to keep in touch with various fascist groups throughout the world. Burroughs also enjoyed corresponding with former Nazi German military officials, to include Otto Skorzeny. Lee Harvey Oswald's entry of Burroughs' name and his entire notebook were published in the Warren Commission's 26 volumes of evidence, but the commission made no attempt to explain it, perhaps considering it a red herring. The FBI knew about Burroughs and his position within the American Nazi Party, but apparently made no attempt to relay the information to the Warren Commission. The New York City FBI opened a file on Burroughs in January of 1963 and was in receipt of information about him from the New York City police. They were aware that Burroughs had been arrested for pasting swastikas on the walls of the Anti-Defamation League in 1960. Burroughs had been arrested in July 1960 for counter-picketing CORE demonstrators, that's C-O-R-E demonstrators, who were protesting against the discriminatory hiring practices at a White Castle restaurant in the Bronx. White Castle.
CORE was the organization, the Congress of Racial Equality, a civil rights organization in the 1960s. Go ahead, Nati.
That's correct, of which Lee Harvey Oswald attempted to join at one point in 1963. Purportedly, the two men that drove him, excuse me, I had to take a drink. The two men that drove him to the CORE organizing event in Louisiana, according to all the eyewitnesses, were Guy Bannister, David Ferry, and Clay Shaw.
Now, is this the Clinton, Louisiana affair?
That's correct. The Clinton, okay. Louisiana voter registration drive headed by CORE. And Mr. Oswald apparently tried to join the organization at that voter registration event, of which Mr. Bannister, Clay Shaw, and David Ferry were attendees. We know are of a leftist ilk, right? What does Clay Shaw describe himself as a Wilson, Roosevelt leftist? Yeah.
Oh yeah. Well, the entire milieu. My favorite word again. Then the George Lincoln Rockwell's Arlington, Virginia name and address were in Oswald's address book, as was Dan Burroughs, were they not?
That is correct.
And again, Oswald's presented as a quote, communist, unquote. What the hell is George Lincoln Rockwell's name doing in his address book then? I mean, it's surreal. By the way, Daniel Burroughs, I just want to fill in very briefly. We've spoken about him before. He allegedly committed suicide after the New York Times, the publishers of the Warren Report, by the way, and also the CIA's number one propaganda asset, after the New York Times published an article that he was of Jewish extraction. And he allegedly committed suicide at the Pennsylvania home of the aforementioned Roy Frankhauser, who himself had worked on a contract basis for both CIA and NSA. As Frankhauser said in the book The Klan by Patsy Sims, quote, bad case of suicide, 3 bullets, but that's what they said, unquote. So fascinating, the thing. But go ahead. This is all conspiracy theory. Everything is wonderful. I mean, just watch the Olympics. I'll tell you all about it. Go ahead.
Hey, continuing. The Secret Service, however, took note of Oswald's Burroughs entry, reading again. The Secret Service, however, took note of Oswald's Burroughs entry, and on December 12, 1963, asked the Washington field office to investigate the matter. It is not known if they followed through. In July of 1964, he was convicted on the charge to riot and was sent to Sing Sing prison. In 1976, U.S. Secret Select Committee, reading again. In 1976, the U.S. Senate Select Committee on Intelligence Activities showed slightly more interest in the Burroughs entry in Oswald's notebook when they asked for FBI files on Burroughs. 2 February 1976, the committee requested from the Justice Department, quote, delivery of all materials pertaining to Dan Burroughs, alleged member of the National States Rights Party in 1963, end quote. The House Select Committee, on the other hand, did not apparently take to the enigmatic Burroughs notation matter into consideration. District Attorney Jim Garrison was aware of Bannister's connection with Rockwell and the Burroughs entry in Oswald's notebook. Jim Garrison knew of Burroughs and Partley's participation in the hate bus incident from Rockwell's New Orleans police file. This is file number E-11897-61, which was part of the DA's radical right-wing file. Burroughs avoided arrests when he was instructed by George Lincoln Rockwell to stay at the hotel and await orders from him and the New Orleans Nazis. Garrison noted that the American Nazi Party in Dallas operated out of P.O. Box 22071, Dallas, Texas, 75202. And the American Nazi Party and the National States Rights Party membership roles were similar. Garrison also wrote a confidential memo to file entitled, quote, probable National States Rights Party makeup for three cities, end quote. He listed the Los Angeles National States Rights Party as consisting of the following persons, quote, Colonel William Potter Gale, Edgar Eugene Bradley, Clinton Wheat, Dr. Stanley Denham, and Jim Bradley. He also named Guy Bannister, David Ferry, Lewis Davis, Kent Courtney, Carlos Bringer, Tommy Balmer, Delphine Roberts, Dr. Gerald Mariter, Dr. Frederick Degry Beck, Tommy Compton, and Dr. Gustav von Heer as the New Orleans representatives of the National States Rights Party.
Delphine Roberts, by the way, was Guy Bannister's secretary. Braden, is that Jim Braden or Edgar Eugene Bradley?
Both Jim Braden and Edgar Eugene Bradley are separate entities inside of Jim Garrison's probable NSRP makeup for three cities report. They're mentioned as separate persons.
Okay, very good.
Continuing, and I'll circle back to Bernie real quick, but continuing, Garrison claimed that the Dallas National States Rights Party was composed of General Edwin A. Walker, individuals of the Dallas Police Force, Joe Cody, the Reverend O.P. Graham, Frederick Lorenz, J.D. Tibbett, and Warren Reynolds.
J.D. Tibbett, of course, the Dallas policeman who was shot dead shortly after President Kennedy was assassinated, allegedly shot by Lee Harvey Oswald, but the evidence there just doesn't add up at all. So
no, it does not.
J.D. Tibbett is looming ever large in the Dallas conspiracy analysis, and the fact that he was in Garrison's files as an NSRP operative. He also, by the way, J.D. Tibbett was a crack shot and is alleged to have been, very possibly been, quote, badge man, unquote, in the Mary Moorman photograph. There was one of the gunmen behind the fence on the grassy knoll was wearing a Dallas policeman's uniform, and blow-ups of the photograph do have some resemblance to J.D. Tibbett. Go ahead.
I would note it's very disturbing, that analysis right there, if that's true. But I have my own opinions on who the badge man may be. I actually believe that, and this is my own personal analysis and own personal editorial. This is just Monty speaking off the hip. I believe that the badge man is actually an OAS assassin by the name of Captain Jean-Marie René Swetra, but that's just my opinion.
So Swetra was an OAS operative who was in Dallas and was shepherded out of the U.S. into Mexico shortly after the assassination. Yeah, I would not bank on that being Tippett, because the photograph, the blow-up is so green. We can say that whoever that was, he was firing a rifle, and he was wearing a Dallas policeman's uniform, whoever he was.
Right, right. And the only reason why I mentioned Swetra is because when he was operating in Algeria under the 5th Psychological Parachute Battalion, the exact same force that Robert Leroy and Otto Skorzeny are training in 1956 and 57, respectively, I should note that Captain Swetra's favorite disguise that he liked to use in Algeria was pretending to be a local police officer. So,
oh, fascinating. Fascinating.
Continuing, though, with the account Lee Harvey Oswald and the Nazis from General Walker in the Murder of President Kennedy. Quote, Dan Burroughs enlisted in the United States Army in 1955 and had served under the command of General Walker. Walker was ordered to Little Rock, Arkansas to enforce the federally mandated integration of public schools by President Eisenhower. Walker objected to the order and tried to get relieved of his command, but Eisenhower refused his paperwork of relieving. Private Burroughs appeared on television escorting a black child to school. He later left the Army over the Little Rock deployment, stating he didn't like protecting, well, I'm not going to repeat the expletive, but...
this is the same Dan Burroughs who also then later becomes an American Nazi Party member.
Correct.
Okay, very good. I did not realize he was in the Army under Walker's command at Little Rock.
Oh, absolutely.
Go ahead. That is a fascinating connection. Go ahead.
Right. And in keeping with Mr. Skorzeny operating purportedly at Fort Benning, Georgia, I should like to note that Dan Burroughs was trained as a United States Army infantryman at Fort Benning, Georgia, roughly around the same time that Otto Skorzeny is purportedly there training parachutes infantrymen. I should note another person that's also training at Fort Benning, Georgia at one point in his military career is Roy Frankhauser, and I'll get to that in a minute.
Wow, go ahead.
Continuing, Walker objected to the order and tried to get relieved of the command, but tried to get relieved of his command, but was refused. Private Burroughs appeared on television escorting a black child to the school. He later left the Army over the Little Rock deployment, stating he didn't like protecting Burroughs described Walker as a man of destiny. Regarding the origins of his right-wing leanings, Burroughs stated, I think Little Rock was a turning point for me, end quote. Influenced by an Irish teacher sympathetic to Senator Joseph McCarthy, Burroughs became an admirer of anti-communist senator and grew concerned about the communist menace in high school. One of his favorite books was Undercover, which exposed many known, well-known right-wingers as Nazis like Bannister's friend Edward Hunter, who was an admitted Nazi before World War II. It also exposed a Kent Courtney and Edward Walker associate, Harold Lloyd Varney, last name spelled V-A-R-N-E-Y, the publisher of a well-known far-right magazine, The American Mercury, as a Nazi. After the Kennedy assassination, Burroughs wore a button that he designed that read, Lee Harvey Oswald Fan Club. He became interested in the Ku Klux Klan at a Klan rally in Bear, Delaware. Roy Frankhauser introduced Burroughs to the Imperial Wizard, that's the national leader, of the United Klans of America, Robert Shelton, who cherished Klan members from the North. Frankhauser was the Grand Dragon of the state of Pennsylvania. Shelton swore in Burroughs as Kingle, or organizer, and later as the provisional Grand Dragon of the state of New York in 1965. Frankhauser, whose first ties to the Klan were in 1958, reportedly assaulted a police captain during a segregationist rally in October 1961 in Atlanta, Georgia. Attorneys and prominent leaders in the Klan and the National States Rights Party, J.B. Stoner and James Venable, last name spelled V-E-N-A-B-E-L-E, respectively defended Frankhauser. Interestingly enough, Venable intimated not long before he died in the 1990s that Lee Harvey Oswald had visited his Stone Mountain, Georgia home in 1963. It is also worth noting that Stoner served as the attorney for convicted assassin of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., James Earl Ray. End quote. Just as a slight editorial, I should note that James Earl Ray's brother actually physically assaulted and shot William Luther Pierce III over apparently some kind of drug deal. So
really,
consider that mail you that William Luther Pierce got into some kind of drug problem with James Earl Ray's brother, and James Earl Ray is defended by Stoner, who in turn was in fact an attorney that defended Frankhauser, an intimate apparently of Mr. Oswald.
And
small,
one
small
of J.B. Stoner's bodyguards was one of James Earl Ray's, was James Earl Ray's brother, excuse me.
Right.
You know, just a quick editorial interjection. When I use the word milieu, people, I mean, it's become kind of a joke, and there's Dave again using that word. How else, I think that I cannot think off the top of my head, and I've thought about it for years, what better word would there be?
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is a very small, as we are demonstrating here today, as you've done in previous programs, Mr. Emery, very small milieu, a very tight network of operatives. They are very organized and deadly in their intent, in the effect that they can murder the president of the United States of America and keep everybody's heads firmly up their rear end for about seven decades.
It is amazing. You know, as the more I learn, the more, you know, the term conspiracy theory, I mean, just hear people, oh, well, gee, I don't believe in conspiracy theory, blah, 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 blah. I think networking is a much better term. I was doing some reading through a book called JFK, and I forget the evidence today about the JFK assassination, a book by the
Right.
brilliant Jim DeGenio. And
right.
I did not realize that John J. McCloy, a key Warren Commission member, U.S. High Commissioner of Germany, turned many of these Nazi war criminals loose into the service of the OPC, the Gehlen Org, etc. But John J. McCloy was heavily involved with the internment of Japanese Americans after Pearl Harbor. And one of the guys who really...
Earl Warren was behind that with John J. McCloy.
Absolutely. Earl Warren, of course, who was, he was also the vice presidential candidate for the Republican Party when Thomas Dewey was running against Truman. The campaign manager, officially his title was speech writer, was Alan Dulles. But Earl
That's
Warren,
right.
Was the governor of California that helped to decimate the large Japanese American agricultural middle class in the state. But I did not realize that John J. McCloy worked with Earl Warren, and then, of course, they helped to intern Japanese Americans in camps like Manzanar, and then later their networking in covering up the JFK assassination in the 1960s. So go ahead, Mike. We've not only been lied to systematically, but our understanding of our own history, our understanding of our own politics has been shattered. You use the metaphor of a broken mirror. And yes, that's a very good analogy. And what you have been doing so magnificently for us is taking the pieces of that broken mirror and slowly putting the shards back together so that the real picture emerges. And it is a terrifying picture, albeit one that if we don't come to understand it, we're doomed.
Absolutely. In fact, on that note, I would stress to your listening audience, Dave, truth and reconciliation is the only thing that's going to save us, not an armed revolution. That time came and went about 100 years ago, okay? Truth and reconciliation is the only thing that's going to save us at this point.
Yep, and you know what? I wouldn't make any bets on that happening that you can't cover with liquid assets.
Continuing, though, with General Walker and the murder of President Kennedy, Lee Harvey Oswald, and the Nazis. Quote, prompted by the wave of prompted by the wave of racial violence that gripped the South, the House Committee on Un-American Activities began an investigation of the Klan in 1965. When they named Dan Burroughs as a member of the New York Klan, a member of the Jewish community informed the FBI that Burroughs was Jewish. Having been bar mitzvahed in the Temple Talmud Torah in Richmond Hill section of Queens, not far from Hollis, which later would become home to Dan Burroughs' Nazi activities. A New York Times reporter learned that Burroughs' Nazi and Klan activities and Jewish background. When approached by the reporter, Burroughs stated, if you publish this, I'll come get you and kill you, end quote. Burroughs retreated to Frankhauser's house in Readings, Pennsylvania, where, upon reading the article exposing his Jewish background, he purportedly shot himself in the head 3 times. After Burroughs' death, Frankhauser told New York Times that Burroughs had offered the FBI photostats that connected Lee Harvey Oswald to the Socialist Workers Party. May 18, 1967, FBI memo, an informant told the FBI that Frankhauser had in a secure place letters concerning the assassination of President Kennedy from a person named Payne, spelled spelled Payne. The letters apparently were intended to be given to the informant to Garrison during his investigation, but they never materialized. The information was, however, passed along to the FBI to the Secret Service. Payne was determined to be a reference to Michael Payne, whose wife shared a home with Oswald and his wife before the assassination. Frankhauser, in a 1975 interview, claimed that Ruth and Michael Payne had infiltrated the Socialist Workers Party when they had infiltrated the party in 1960, and that they met Oswald when the Paynes took him to New York for an international science meeting. Frankhauser's story remains unverified and was likely fabricated. End quote. I have some serious reservations with Caulfield and his account. That last one being the most serious. The idea that this was a fabrication on the part of Frankhauser and Dan Burroughs. And it's simply because I have access to Frankhauser's FBI file, and it states the following, if I may quote it.
Sure.
Okay. During 1974-1975, Roy Frankhauser, claiming to be working on behalf of the CIA, established contact with the NCLC. Approximately June 1975, Frankhauser submitted 3 days of intensive debriefings in which he provided details of his employment with the National Security Council on special assignment to penetrate a Canadian base cell of the Palestinian terrorist Black September organization and other aspects of his CIA career dating back to his involvement in the Bay of Pigs invasion.
Frankhauser was involved in the Bay of Pigs?
According to a debriefing that he gave to the FBI, if I may continue, please.
Absolutely.
Frankhauser said he served as babysitter for Mario Garcia Coley, one of the brigade leaders that was to have a high government post in the post-Castro Cuba. As an editorial note, I should note that Mario Garcia Coley's CIA handler within the anti-Castro effort before the Bay of Pigs was a man by the name of Frank Bender. He also went by the name Jerry Droller. Purportedly, Jerry Droller, according to a researcher who wrote a book called a book that was published on the international fascist connections to narco-terrorism. For Pete's sake, what's the name of that book now?
The Great Heroin Coup by Henry Kruger.
Right, by Kruger. Thank you. Thank you, Dave. According to Heinrich Kruger and the Great Heroin Coup, Jerry Droller, the CIA task force commander for the Bay of Pigs invasion before E. Howard Hunt took it over. That same E. Howard Hunt we mentioned earlier as being a superior officer to William F. Buckley. Jerry Droller was actually a Nazi SS Obersturmbannführer by the name of Friedrich Schwend, the commander of Operation Bernhardt. So consider that for a moment, that Mario Garcia Coley's paymaster was actually Jerry Droller, who in all likelihood was an SS Obersturmbannführer by the name of Friedrich Schwend. Consider that when Frankhauser claims that he's a babysitter for Mario Garcia Coley. Now we have two Nazis who claim to have been working with Mario Garcia Coley.
Wow. I mean, it just, you know, one of the things that comes to mind very quickly, you know, the Caulfield book is a really long book. I've read long sections of it, but I have never read the book cover to cover. And it's important to do that. It also is a book that needs handicapping again, because it disclaims repeatedly that there was any involvement by the U.S. intelligence community in, President
Specifically the
Kennedy's.
CIA. Specifically, Dr. Caulfield, he does not believe any of the claims that the Central Intelligence Agency had anything to do structurally or peripherally with the assassination of President Kennedy. And here we have Frank Hauser literally claiming that he's a CIA operative that was involved in the Bay of Pigs invasion.
All of the people, just about all of the people that, obviously all, but a large percentage of the people that Caulfield talks about, however, do have links, either to the CIA or
All of them.
some
All of them.
to Alphabet Soup, as it's called. So.
It is insane that, and I'm sorry to use that word to describe Caulfield's account, but I don't understand why every single main character in his book, Bannister, General Edwin Walker, General Pedro Davalle, General Stratemeyer, General Wiedemeyer, all of the top leaders of the, anti-communist committees that he references in his book have structural, mind you, listening audience, mind you, Mr. Emery, structural CIA connections. Okay.
Yep. Well, I wonder if, you know, possibly, Caulfield, who spent years researching the book, if he was being fed information by CIA and that this was modified limited hangout, or perhaps, you know, giving him perhaps a credit. Maybe he just didn't want the agency up his butt for the rest of his professional life, which they would have, he would have had.
Right. So
But for
did
whatever reason, he disclaims that, and yet the people, as you put it, the dramatis personae of his book, all have links to one or another intelligence agency.
all of them, specifically to the Central Intelligence Agency. And I just want to make this very clear. General Charles Willoughby, as a point of editorial to Frankhauser's FBI debriefing in 1975, I should note that General Charles Willoughby was at one point, and this is proven through CIA documentation. If you'd like me to include it in the Spitfire List comments, I will, Mr. Emery. General Charles Willoughby was a CIA operative in Tokyo. Okay. General Pedro Davalle was a CIA operative in Guam. General Stratemeyer, who was Chief of Air Force Intelligence for the Far East Command during the Second World War, was an OSS commando and a CIA operative. General Wiedemeyer, who was commander of Army Intelligence Forces in mainland China, of which John Birch was one of his subordinates, of the infamous John Birch Society. General Wiedemeyer, Albert Cody Wiedemeyer, was the CIA liaison to United States Army Far East Forces during the Vietnam War, and he later became a special representative to Ronald Reagan in Middle Eastern affairs for the CIA during the Reagan administration. So, I mean, these are all of the top leaders of the American far right that are mentioned inside of Caulfield's book. They all have structural CIA connections.
Yeah, and again, we've spoken about Wiedemeyer in many programs. It's interesting that Vinegar Joe Stilwell, who wanted Chiang Kai-shek to fight the Japanese, was replaced by Wiedemeyer, who had a long fight. I've forgotten who the number two guy in the brown shirts was, but Wiedemeyer actually attended the German Kriegswehr Academy at one point. The
Oh,
German.
that's a man by the name of Kriebel, Hermann Kriebel, that Wiedemeyer was friends with at what was the name of the academy again?
The Kriegswehr Academy.
The Kriegswehr Academy. Interestingly enough, Hermann Kriebel's son, Grigor Kriebel, later became an intimate of Friedrich Schwend when he was operating in Egypt in 1951 with Otto Skorzeny. So consider that for a moment.
I've forgotten who the number two guy in the brown shirts was after, and then after, Ernst Röhm was eliminated on the night of the Long March. Eventually, Wiedemeyer rented his apartment from that guy, and that guy eventually went to work after the war for CIA. I've forgotten his name off the top of my head, but he was the
Well,
number two guy in the brown shirts. But yeah, go ahead. And by the way, Monty, in future programs, I very much want to do the pivot to Asia, as Obama put it, because my research is to a considerable extent Eurocentric. But what you have done on Patreon channel talks that we have, the same scenario presented itself in Asia and with General Seizo Arisu, basically the Japanese Galen, with Kim Suk Won, who was in charge of the border forces for Syngman Rhee in Korea. And he had fought, he was part of the anti-partisan units of the Japanese army. And, Syngman Rhee, No Jin Jiem both worked for the Japanese. And the same scenario that we have seen in Europe also applied in Asia. And I really want to get into the Asian connections in future discussions. Go ahead, Monty.
Absolutely, we will. Continuing with Frankhauser's debriefing to the FBI, Frankhauser said he served as a babysitter for Mario Garcia Colley, one of the Brigade 2506 leaders who was said to have a high government post in post-Castro Cuba. Subsequently, the NCLC researchers found a brief reference to a Pravda report. Perhaps you can tell the listeners what Pravda is real quick, Dave.
It was a Soviet magazine/propaganda outlet.
Right. So, subsequently, the NCLC researchers found a brief reference in Pravda citing a 1962 expulsion of a one United States Army private R. Frankhauser from a low-level post in the U.S. Embassy in Moscow on charges that he was spying for the American CIA.
Oh, fascinating. By the way, when I say the Pravda was a propaganda, that does not mean that everything they said was lies by any chance. One of the many things that, at the age of, for all practical purposes, 75, the pinchback quote, a Nazi plot gargantuan in scope to enslave America in the name of anti-communism. I don't think we will ever know what exactly, quote, communism, unquote, was, because not only was it filtered through this fascist milieu, but if a communist country, whether it was this former Soviet Union, China, whatever, if they were not far more guarded than an, quote, open democracy, unquote, they would have been absolutely destroyed, because they existed in a perpetual state of siege from the very elements that we're talking about. Go ahead, Mike. So, well, according to Pravda, allegedly, Private Roy Frankhauser was spying for the CIA in Moscow?
Correct, in the U.S. Embassy, the exact same U.S. Embassy of which Lee Harvey Oswald claimed that he was going to defect to the Soviet Union to embassy official Richard Schneider. I should note that Richard Schneider of the U.S. Embassy in Moscow was formerly the top CIA recruiter at Yale University. So consider that connection between Oswald, the CIA recruiting establishment at Yale, and Mr. Roy Frankhauser.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Go ahead, Monty.
Continuing with Frankhauser and some of his connections, this is actually not from his FBI report, but just from a slight, claim that was made by the new Solidarity story that was published by the NCLC, which, of course, was a LaRouche publication. So consider that for a moment, the source of this information. But it is fascinating what is claimed about Frankhauser. Quote, FBI attachment number 2 information in June 1975. So they're referencing the same FBI file that I'm looking at. The NCLC spent 3 full days intensively debriefing Frankhauser. Some months later, the NCLC publicly declared that Frankhauser's revelations would prove critical in the unmasking of the real killers of John F. Kennedy. Huh. Interesting. This bold assertion first surfaced in 27 October 1975, new Solidarity report penned by a top member of the group's security staff by the name of Scott Thompson, who maintained close ties with select members of the radical right. On 20 November 1975, the same Scott Thompson who wrote what was billed to be the first series of articles highlighting Frankhauser's claims about a plot to kill President Kennedy. To this day, Frankhauser is most famous for the fact that in late 1965, the quote Jewish Nazi, end quote, Dan Burroughs killed himself in Frankhauser's Reading, Pennsylvania home after the New York Times published an expose on Burroughs' Jewish roots. Burroughs' spectacular death, however, has now been overshadowed a closer look at Frankhauser's activities inside the far right. Now, with the help of newly released FBI files, we can now shed a remarkable light on his subterranean world.
By the way, I just want to interject very quickly. The LaRouche material can be quite educational if, and this is with a capital I and a capital F, one sees it in its proper perspective. My late dear friend Mae Bussell, I got overly seduced, in my opinion, by the LaRouche material, and that was a source of considerable friction between us. Like I would kept telling her, look, the guy is basically a fascist. And if you take a look at the LaRouche material, you know, a lot of which can be very illuminating, sooner or later, it all gets back to the Jews, you know. So people need to be very careful because Executive Intelligence Review, that's the most sophisticated of the LaRouche publications, can have some very good information in it. But again, if you're not careful, you will be seduced because sooner or later, it all comes back to the Jews. And my opinion is that in effect, they may not be doctrinaire, but in effect, they are Nazis.
Right. So I'm happy to report that I'm going to pivot dramatically out of that milieu. continuing with I'm going to pivot to a professor by the name of Jerry Rose, who wrote for a journal called The Fourth Decade. And this was written in 1996 by Professor Jerry Rose, talking about Frankhauser's background concerning the assassination of President Kennedy and his purported infiltration of an organization called the Socialist Workers' Party and their youth group, the Young Socialist Alliance. Bear in mind, that's the same organization that Jim Garrison identified in 1967 as Lee Harvey Oswald and Michael Payne, of all people, were trying to infiltrate in Dallas, Texas, okay? As a point of fact, Michael Payne was using the alias Mr. Oswald when he was infiltrating the Young Socialist Alliance. So, if I may, this comes from an article written in June of 1996 by Professor Jerry Rose in the Fourth Decade Journal, okay?
Good.
Quote, let's see. In doing so, I hope to shed new light not only on Frankhauser, but his associates such as the Klan Bureau of Investigation, the KBI leader, Eugene Tabbitt, last name spelled T-A-B-B-U-T-T, Tabbitt. Their saga will also take us into the subterranean universe of a highly cryptic group called the Knights of Malta of St. John of Jerusalem, Shikshini, a pseudo-chivalristic order which maintains ties to key members of the far right. As veteran listening programs of this program will know, the head of the Military Affairs Committee for the Shikshini Knights of Malta was a United States Army colonel by the name of Philip Corso, okay, who was the former military affairs liaison to OSS Commander James Angleton when he occupies Rome in 1944. All right. Consider this. That the man that is attacking Jim Garrison in 1967 is a subordinate of James Angleton, Lieutenant Colonel Raymond George Rocha. So consider that milieu for a moment between the Knights of Malta, Raymond George Rocha, and James Angleton, not to mention Frankhauser and Frankhauser's connections to the Klan Bureau of Investigation. Continuing.
And of course, Ray Rocha was deputy director of counterintelligence under James Angleton. He was in charge of the Garrison force that was the Garrison task force that wasn't supporting Jim Garrison, but that was in New Orleans trying to torpedo, and not trying, but effectively torpedoing his investigation. But Ray Rocha, who was the acknowledged expert on the JFK assassination and the Garrison investigation of same within CIA, opined that Garrison would get a conviction of Clay Shaw.
Correct. Continuing, there are numerous fascinating links to the Kennedy assassination involving members of the far right, and Frankhauser's story brings that story into more focus. Finally, Frankhauser's serpentine sojourn inside the Trotskyite movement raises the real possibility that when Frankhauser claimed to have met LaRouche during a period in which he operated in the world of the SWP, he may have well been telling the truth. If so, the question has to be asked whether or not Frankhauser LaRouche connection actually began much earlier, but only publicly surfaced in the mid-1970s. However, what is of most interest here is a detailed examination of Roy Frankhauser's attempt starting sometime in late 1959 and early 1960 to infiltrate a small Trotskyite organization headquarters in New York City called the Socialist Workers' Party and its youth organizational group, the Young Socialist Alliance. Frankhauser claimed that what he learned while infiltrating the SWP would prove directly relevant to the question of who shot President Kennedy. He tried three times to peddle his revelations, first to the Warren Commission in 1964, second to New Orleans DA Jim Garrison in 1967, and finally to the House Select Committee on Assassinations in 1975, this last attempt with the NCLC, that's the LaRouche Organization. Recently, declassified FBI files show that Frankhauser did in fact infiltrate the ranks of the local Socialist Workers' Party in the Philadelphia region in the 1950s, as well as in New York City, where the SWP had its national headquarters. I should note, once again, this is the exact same SWP organization that Lee Harvey Oswald and Michael Payne infiltrate in Dallas, Texas.
And continuing. By the way, Bernie Sanders was a presidential candidate for the SWP back in the day. There are many policy stances of Bernie Sanders with which I am in agreement, but I watched the ascent of the Sanders candidacy. People never ask, why was Karl Rove bankrolling Bernie Sanders' 2016 presidential campaign through his American Crossroads Super PAC? I don't have a specific answer, but I suspect because Bernie Sanders, with that quasi, 60s hippie perspective that he has, was in favor of having anyone able to vote in primaries, and that, of course, would permit Republicans to select the Democratic presidential candidate. And, this is a revolutionary concept, Monty, but I would submit that if you want to vote in the Democratic primary, you should register as a Democrat. If you want to vote in the Republican primary, you should register as a Republican. But Bernie Sanders said that everybody could vote in the primaries. That, of course, would have permitted the Republicans to select the presidential candidate. I suspect that is one of the reasons why Karl Rove was bankrolling Bernie Sanders' 2016 presidential campaign. Go ahead, please.
Right. Continuing with Frankhauser's background, if I may, I'm going to skip forward a little bit inside of this reference, which I will post in its entirety on Spitfire List so people can follow along with me. But in talking about Roy Frankhauser and the potential that he may be a spy for the CIA, or at least some type of COINTEL pro-S domestic element that's operating within the United States Army at this time, I'm going to go ahead and continue to quote from the Fourth Decade article. Published in 1996, if I may.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, says right here that, I'm going to skip forward a little bit in this article. Born in Reading on 11 April 1939, Royson Everett Frankhauser Jr. led a classic troubled childhood. His father, who in the late 1950s had been living as a barber, had a violent temper, and the family lived in constant fear. Frankhauser recalls that his father, who said he had once been a musician, also wound up joining the Ku Klux Klan. Frankhauser's father also reportedly served in a federal prison for at least two armed robberies. Frankhauser's mother, Lottie, who divorced her husband in 1950, testified that Royston Sr. was, quote, always drinking, always violent and profane, went into rages, threatened suicide often, and always said he hated all Jews and Catholics. He used to shout out Heil Hitler just to annoy his neighbors. That's Frankhauser's father. Continuing. After the divorce, Frankhauser lived with his mother and his stepfather. He may have also been at times a ward of the state. Sounds like Mr. Oswald, right? Continuing. A Berks County juvenile probation officer told the FBI that while Frankhauser was never placed under the care of his office by the court, they had supervised him unofficially because of his parental troubles. Just like Mr. Oswald. For his part, Frankhauser recalled around that time and the time of the divorce, he spent time in a children's home, and later recalled that living in the children's home, I admired strength. I lived in a society that seemed to be absolutely weak. They could break up my family and throw me in a home, and where was the all-American bounty? What kind of country was this? That's Frankhauser speaking, incidentally. Continuing. Frankhauser soon became a problem in school, twice flunking in the ninth grade. Around that time, he began passionately collecting World War II Nazi regalia. Most likely through his father's old Reading Ku Klux Klan connection, he met Clarence Seidel, described in, and his last name is spelled S-E-I-D-E-L, described in FBI files as the former exalted Cyclops of the Reading's Ku Klux Klan, number 265.
I believe that's pronounced Reading.
Yeah, Reading, excuse me, thank you.
R-E-A-D-I-N-G, go ahead.
Yeah. Grand Titan of Berks County, Pennsylvania. After Frankhauser dropped out of high school, he joined the United States Army paratroopers. And he told the librarian at Fort Bragg Army Base in North Carolina that he wanted to develop contact with the local Ku Klux Klan. I should note, this is the exact same time that Otto Skorzeny is purportedly training United States Army paratroopers at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and Fort Benning, Georgia.
Wonderful. Go ahead.
Continuing. He then gave the librarian a letter of recommendation written by Spadell to prove Frankhauser's authenticity and sincerity in seeking membership in the Klan. During his time in the Army, Frankhauser established ties to Eaton Lee Edwards of East Point, Georgia. A one-time paint sprayer at General Motors Fisher Body Plant in Atlanta, Edwards also happened to be the Grand Imperial Wizard of the U.S. Clans of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klans Incorporated in the state of Georgia, exactly where Mr. Otto Skorzeny is operating, purportedly. Continuing. The little we know about Frankhauser's time in the U.S. Army comes from an investigation of Frankhauser's career as a rightist U.S. government informant extraordinaire conducted by John George and Lard Wilcox in their book, Nazis, Communist Klansmen, and Others on the Fringe. They report that Frankhauser joined the United States Army 6 November 1956 and specifically volunteered for the 82nd Airborne in order to be sent to Germany. As a devout collector of Nazi memorabilia and as well as a Ku Klux Klan sympathizer, even as a young man, Frankhauser soon engaged in a number of half-baked plots that immediately brought him under the attention of Army authorities and military police at Fort Bragg. Frankhauser even developed a scheme to have himself declared officially dead so he can leave the Army to join the neo-Nazi movement, hoping to rise in a position of prominence. Aha, fake his own death. In 2 July 1957, Frankhauser stated that he planned to desert the United States Army and join the revolutionary forces in Cuba. In fact, he went AWOL and arrived in Miami, Florida, 5 July 1957 to do precisely that. He was taken into custody by the local MPs shortly thereafter and returned to his military unit. Army records reflect that Frankhauser was discharged 18 November 1957 under the provisions of AR-635-209, which is unfit for military service. So there is some reality that Frankhauser did in fact try to join the anti-Castro, the pro-Castro, later anti-Castro movement. I should note that a few men that are operating in that milieu that flip, that go from pro-Castro to anti-Castro include William Alexander Morgan, Frank Sturgis, and Jerry Patrick Hemming, three men that were sent into Cuba by Frank Bender. And I should note that Frank Bender was, in fact, the CIA handler of Mario Garcia Colley, the Brigade 2506 commander of which Roy Frankhauser claims to be an intimate of. Very interesting. Continuing.
By the way, Mark, we have about 5 minutes left in this program. Go ahead.
Sure. After his AWOL, it states the following, and I'll skip forward as to what he's doing purportedly as an FBI informant in this time period. It says right here, during this same period in the late 1950s, Roy Frankhauser began cultivating connections to the SWP and other leftist groups. Frankhauser would later claim that what he learned during this period would shed new light on President Kennedy's death. Remarkably, Frankhauser promised revelations about JFK assassination first surfaced not in the pages of the National States Rights Party paper, The Thunderbolt, of which I should note that Carlos Berenguer was an editor of the National States Rights Party's paper, The Thunderbolt, but in some KKK-affiliated hate sheets, but in the pages of the prestigious New York Times. In a 1 November 1965 article on the Dan Burrell suicide, the Times interviewed Frankhauser in his Reading home. After telling the Times that he had served as a spy for the Virginia White Citizens Council, the WCC, and in this capacity had infiltrated communist and Negro meetings in Louisiana, Frankhauser declared that soon after the assassination of President Kennedy, he offered to give the Federal Bureau of Investigation photostats that showed Socialist Worker Party had a training camp with which Lee Harvey Oswald, the alleged assassin, was connected, end quote. Well, what can we pull from all of this information? The fact of the matter is that Frankhauser is in the exact same milieu, not only of Otto Sforzeni, but of the anti-Castro elements surrounding Carlos Berenguer and Lee Harvey Oswald.
And by the way, Berenguer's editing of the Thunderbolt magazine, that's the same Carlos Berenguer who is ostensibly hostile to Lee Harvey Oswald, but he appears on the WBSU radio program with Ed Butler and Lee Harvey Oswald and Jim Stuckey. And that interview, which Oswald proclaims his Marxist sympathies, was broadcast all over the U.S. the night of President Kennedy's assassination.
Absolutely correct. And that has to be seen through this lens because, according to a book put out by the late Kevin Coogan called The Spy Who Would Be Tsar, The Mystery of Mikhail Golininsky and the Far Right, I'd like to quote directly from that book, if I may. This is on page 257 of this book.
We've got less than 3 minutes left, so if you could just pick a couple sentences.
Right, and this is from a chapter 12, White Russians in Manhattan. Quote, in the United States, the history of the Knights of St. John Jerusalem Shikshini explains that White Russian Prince Anastase Valakovsky and Howard Bronstrup led the fledgling Russian nationalist field force from Miami, Florida. Paul Winter of the Knights of St. John of Jerusalem, longtime associated with the Grand Chancellor Charles Pitchall of the Knights of St. John of Jerusalem and former Ku Klux Klan leader from New York and Philadelphia, was involved with the American Nationalist Organization that was aligning themselves with Baltic Germans Ulrich Fleischenhauser, Schalbrecht Bork, and Alfred Rosenberg of the Ostministerium. Now, that reference in the book, I'm going directly to the reference section of the book. This is reference 158 of chapter 12 of the book, The Spy Who Would Be Tsar, by Kevin Coogan, states the following, quote, Winter, Ninth Secretary General, is listed in Pitchell's History of the Knights of the Masters of Ceremony Lecturer, President of the Law Enforcement League of Pennsylvania, life member of the International Police Association. The Knights, meaning the Knights of St. John of Jerusalem, and other security chief, Eugene Cabot, ran counterintelligence operations infiltrating leftist organizations in New Orleans for Robert Shelton's Ku Klux Klan. Cabot's group was called the Klan Bureau of Investigation. And Roy Frankhauser is the top investigator of the Klan Bureau of Investigation, of whom Robert Talbot reports to Charles Pitchall of the Knights of St. John of Jerusalem under General Charles Willoughby in 1963.
Fascinating. And this is in the book, The Spy Who Would Be Tsar, by the late, brilliant Kevin Coogan, the author of Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yaki and the Postwar Fascist International. That is a book that
What can I say, Mr. Emmy? Roy Frankhauser is a full-fledged operative of a Gladio right-wing milieu within the United States that is being sponsored by transatlantic elements through The Knights of St. John of Jerusalem, Shikshini, of General Charles Willoughby.
That is brilliant, but we are all out of time. This concludes For the Record program number 1338. Conversations with Monty. This is conversation number 12. This is being recorded on July 27th of the year 2024. For Monty, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.